Once again, it is my pleasure to be visiting with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the author of The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, published in 1994 by the St. Martin's Press in hardcover. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
No, thank you.
We were speaking before our break about the machinations of the petroleum industry as it relates to the world of espionage and intelligence, and we were also speaking about the resultant duplicity in American policy toward Israel. As someone who's lived in California since the late 1970s, I have very vivid memories of the great distress that was experienced by the residents of the Golden State during the, quote, oil shortage, unquote, of the 1970s, specifically 1979. One of the most remarkable aspects of your book, one of many remarkable aspects of your book, is a discussion of that, quote, oil shortage, unquote. And, well, perhaps you'd like to explain why I'm putting that in quotes.
Well, there was no oil shortage. It was a fraud. The oil industry and CIA's oil analysts had, by the time of the Carter administration, a really interlocking relationship. And the long and short of it was that the new president, as he was coming in, received these dire warnings from CIA that there's going to be a major oil shortage. The Saudis were running out of oil. The Russians were going to run out of oil. They were going to invade the Middle East. And we had to start arming the Arabs. And Carter believed it. But to the surprise of the oil companies, his answer was oil conservation, which infuriated them. But anyway, the whole scam was intended to make sure that Carter was a one-term president. As soon as Reagan came into office, all of a sudden the CIA miraculously reversed their dramatic doomsday predictions that oil was running out, and the world was awash in oil. There was actually an oil surplus.
This oil shortage, again, actually was designed, in part at least, to destabilize Jimmy Carter and to make him unpopular as a president.
Oh, very much so.
And boy, it sure worked in California, I'll tell you.
Yep.
That was an epicenter of anti-Carter sentiment. That scam had a number of implications, many of which are not only with us today, but I'm afraid, John, are likely to be bedeviling not only the American people, but in light of America's position in the world financial and industrial community, the whole world, for quite some time to come. The Arabs, in particular Saudi Arabia, was armed by the United States and specifically given AWACS as a result of this.
Hey, we changed the balance of power in the Middle East. Israel was no longer America's largest aircraft carrier. All of a sudden, we armed the Arabs to the teeth.
One of the things that also resulted from this deliberate deception on the part of the petroleum industry and its field-level operatives within the intelligence community, and again, I think one of the many very important points of your book is that it illustrates in a dramatic and conclusive fashion the connections between the operations of the intelligence community and the powerful forces of industry and finance at whose behest.
It's not quite a conspiracy. The guys, the analysts in the CIA, were largely duped. What happened is that their retired colleagues working for the oil companies fed them false information.
Mm-hmm.
The oil companies, quite frankly, are a perfect cover for collecting intelligence in the Middle East. And they're also a perfect vehicle for distorting intelligence. So they literally jimmied all of the oil production forecasts coming back to CIA. And the analysts reported what they thought were the true facts. They had no idea that their old retired colleagues in the oil companies had conned them.
One of the results of this con was the enormous military buildup under Ronald Reagan, as we make the transition now from the Carter administration to the first Reagan administration. There was, of course, an enormous military buildup.
The phony oil shortage and the future war in the Middle East, that was the justification for borrowing more money than all American presidents combined.
Which, of course, tripled the national debt by the time Ronald Reagan left office, having campaigned under a banner of fiscal responsibility, a situation George Bush compounded. Now, one of the things that you and Mr. Ahrens talk about in your book, and that is, on the one hand, the profound role of the Bechtel Corporation in the Reagan administration, and also the Bechtel Corporation's deeply anti-Semitic outlook as a result of their operations in the Middle East.
Yeah. Bechtel was one of the corporations that was found to be guilty of adhering to the Arab embargo against sales to Israel. Bechtel has been in the Middle East for a long time. They're in bed with the Arabs. They are entirely pro-Arab. The only Bechtel guy to emerge from this whole thing with some honor was Secretary of State George Shultz, who got so fed up with all the broken promises from the Arab states that he actually had somewhat of a pro-Israeli stance, which accounts in many people's minds for why he was, you know, asked to resign pretty promptly. The irony is when Shultz got back to Bechtel, he discovered that Bechtel was constructing a dual-use chemical plant, and it could be used to manufacture the precursors for poison gas, the original Nazi formula. Mm-hmm. Shultz ordered the plant halted, okay? And it would have been irony if Bechtel had finished a poison gas plant for Saddam Hussein just before the Gulf War. Now, there's an interesting tie-in with Jonathan Pollard here, because Pollard had warned the Israelis that the West Germans were building the plants, and Pollard may not have realized that he blew the whistle on his own boss, Kath Weinberger, who was also a Bechtel. Now, I haven't seen any documents indicating that, Weinberger had direct knowledge of the poison gas plant contract. And I think quite unlikely that he did know about it, or he would have not taken such a high profile in the Jonathan Pollard case. But Pollard is the classic example of a guy who, well, admittedly committed a crime and should deserve to spend 3 years in prison, was sentenced to 40 years because he'd stumbled on something much more important. He had stumbled on a major political scandal.
The Pollard spy case and its relationship to some of the things that Mr. Pollard probably did not understand the significance of brings us to a discussion of some of the intelligence-related scandals in the 1980s. Of course, George Bush was former director of Central Intelligence and an individual whose genesis goes back to many of the things that we've already discussed. His genesis as a political creature, actually his genesis as a physical creature going back to his Nazi collaborating progenitors. But the overlapping scandals of the Iran-Contra scandal, the Iraqgate/BNL scandal, and many of the other intelligence-related scandals of the 1980s, the BCCI scandal, have as one of their focal points something that I've focused on in my research and something that is dealt with, I think, in detailed very clear fashion by you and your co-author, and that is what you and Mr. Ahrens refer to as a private intelligence agency run by George Bush. This grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism and the recommendations coming out of it. You refer to that alternately as the Special Situations Group and a Pre-Crisis Planning Group.
Yeah, that was the subcommittee for the Special Situations Group. We have top secret White House documents. We got the classified showing that in 1982, Vice President George Bush was put in charge of his own little spy agency and that Oliver North was the officer assigned to detail the work of the committee. And they had a lot of cockamamie ideas. In the Middle East, their idea was to recruit an indigenous force of Lebanese that could be used to run around and kidnap Arab terrorists. Well, actually, it was a thinly disguised assassination program. And when the paperwork was drawn up and submitted to Bush and then went over to CIA, oh, the CIA went wild. And, they were calling Oliver North up in the middle of the night saying, this is crazy. Who ever heard of such a program? And the idea was officially shelved. Well, what happened is that unofficially it went forward. There was a guy from U.S. Special Forces, Bill Buckley, who was a friend of Casey's over at CIA. And
not to be confused, by the way, with the famous columnist also with the CIA.
not that.
Right.
This is another Bill Buckley.
Sure.
And he was sent to Lebanon to organize the kidnap teams. And Buckley himself got kidnapped, and that caused a big uproar. Because if Buckley was tortured, he could really spill the beans about George Bush. Back when Bush was CIA director, he had used Buckley and a British agent to evade the congressional arms ban on arms to Angola. And now when Buckley was kidnapped, Bush went to the British and said, hey, can we send arms to Iran? Well, within 2 weeks of Buckley being kidnapped, the British agent was putting together an arms deal. And the ship was supposed to depart Greece and go to Iran. Now, at the same time, Jonathan Pollard, this is lowly clerk working at Naval Intelligence, and he stumbles across this pattern of PLO arms shipments coming out of Greece, going to Yemen. So in April, he tips off the Israelis. Watch the Greek shipments. The Israelis confirm it. They tell the Greek government. In May, the Greek government raids a ship full of arms. Well, Pollard didn't realize it, but he had just raided George Bush's first arms shipment to Iran.
And again, the genesis of the Iran-Contra scandal did not come with the Israelis or even
This is a year before the Israelis were ever involved.
But it came from George Bush as the main operative and as a vehicle, the private intelligence agency that he was running out of the SSG CPPG.
Yep. And the irony is that there was a major scandal. First of all, it was totally illegal. And second of all, the guy, the Syrian middleman they had contracted to buy the weapons and ship them to Iran, turns out to have been a terrorist. Now, I know this sounds bizarre, but all of the North actually hired a Syrian terrorist and put him on the White House payroll.
This, by the way, is a name that is very well known to my listeners. A fellow, again, who would appear obscure to most people, but a fellow named Manzer al-Kassar, who is identified in your book and dealt with extensively as the principal operative in the Iran-Contra arms transfers.
Yep, Manzer al-Kassar was the guy who bought the communist weapons for the Contras, and he was also the guy that did the major hostage negotiations. The Israelis were brought in a year later as scapegoats. They were only allowed to ship low-level stuff, some obsolete TOW missiles and spare parts for Hawk missiles, things like that. The new high-tech stuff was all going through Manzer and the Syrians to Iran. But what we didn't realize was that Manzer was a real terrorist. I mean, there's a congressional report saying that Manzer's syndicate's responsible for 20% of the heroin that reaches the United States. Interpol had an entire conference on Manzer. He helped blow up the Paris synagogue. His crew helped hijack the Achille Lauro, all sorts of wonderful things.
By the way, he was recently acquitted of piracy in Spain on those charges.
Yeah, well, that was not surprising. One witness against him fell out a window, and the other witness had his children kidnapped, and all the American DEA evidence was excluded.
So, a fascinating bit of a quote.
So here's the joke. Jonathan Pollard is the guy that inadvertently threatened to ruin Bush's run for the presidency by exposing this arms shipment. He's in jail, and the real villain, Manzer al-Kassar, walks around free. Pollard knew too little. Manzer knew too much.
And Manzer al-Kassar was not only a major terrorist, but, as you pointed out, a major drug dealer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
One of the elements that figures centrally in the Iran-Contra scandal, and it's something that you deal with at great length in the latter part of your book, is the BCCI, also the focus of an unfortunately attenuated investigation here in the United States.
Well, it was just too embarrassing. It's the BCCI, the joke is it stands for the British cover for collecting intelligence. The British came up with the idea of setting up a phony Arab bank so they could trace terrorist money. It was a real good idea, especially because the British were employing Manzer to lure all the other Arab terrorists to put their money in the bank. So that's why there were no terrorist attacks in Britain and the United States. We had them all wiretap. Of course, we weren't telling Israel, but that was too bad for them. Unfortunately, the British put a bunch of Pakistani crooks in charge of the day-to-day operation of the bank and ended up costing innocent people around the world some $20 billion in losses. But we just walked away from it.
And the BCCI was actually a British intelligence operation.
Sure. Well, partly. The British had the London of the bank wiretap, but they needed to get a big wiretap station in the Gulf States. So that was when George Bush, as head of CIA, took a $400 million allocation, and we built a listening post down there precisely for that purpose.
One of the things that you discuss in your book is that as the CIA was forming liaisons with the Palestine Liberation Organization, terrorist attacks against Americans were halted, but that it was deemed okay, or at least tolerable, to permit PLO and other Middle East terrorist groups to continue to commit attacks against Jews.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's one of the things that outraged Pollard. He's sitting there and he's reading intelligence reports. We knew in advance of which PLO people would be coming across the borders from Lebanon and attacking which village.
The something that I have focused on in my program is the conflicts that were occurring as George Bush gave way ultimately to Bill Clinton between elements of military intelligence and elements of the civilian intelligence agencies. I'd like to read just a few sentences from page 485 of your book, again, bearing in mind the position of Manzer al-Kassar and BCCI in the Iran-Contra scandal. And by the way, we should also perhaps mention that the use of British intelligence by George Bush and company, and there's a pun there, as a back channel, and it was British intelligence that was centrally involved in Iran-Contra, dates all the way back to the Angola operation that,
yep,
that you mentioned.
Precisely.
A military intelligence group called the Intelligence Support Activity is discussed by you and Mr. Ahrens, and you write on page 485 and 6, one group almost blew the whistle on Bush, the members of the Intelligence Support Activity, or ISA. This top-secret American commando group had been sent to Lebanon to rescue the hostages by force. The ISA got lucky and developed a network of Lebanese informants that uncovered the hostages' whereabouts. By November of 1986, the commandos had gathered all the intelligence, maps of the various Iranian compounds, and even the names of the Syrian officers who shuttled the captives back and forth. One Pentagon source showed us the documents, with details down to the license plate numbers. The commandos had a positive identification of all six surviving hostages. They were ready to rescue them when suddenly they were told to stop collecting intelligence and come home. In the end, the truth was too embarrassing. The problem with the ISA team was that it was too good. It was flooding U.S. intelligence channels with highly accurate reports on Manzur al-Qasar, General Kanaan, and the Syrian drug runners who controlled the kidnappers. The Army had no idea that al-Qasar was working for the White House on hostage ransom. The ISA's sin was success. It had dug up too much of the truth. That's a fascinating example of something that you deal with at great length throughout your book, which is intelligence agencies and national security agencies getting their wires crossed.
Oh, yeah. One old spy said to think of American intelligence in terms of the African centipede theory. The African centipede has 50 sets of opposing male and female sex organs, and it sits around all day having intercourse with itself.
I'm glad you amended that for air.
Yeah, that was a little more colorful in the original.
Okay. One of the things that I've wondered, and I'd like to perhaps skip down to the bottom of page 486, where, again, you write, we regret to confirm that Youssef Haidar, now he was a Syrian intelligence operative, also in contact with the Soviets, wasn't
he?
Yeah,
he's the man who actually tortured Bill Buckley to death.
Right, well, as the sentence goes on, we regret to confirm that Youssef Haidar, the man who tortured Buckley to death, was subsequently observed in Washington, D.C. with a VIP escort by Agent John Lipka, L-I-P-K-A, of the FBI. Shortly after Haidar's visit, Bush announced to the press that the Syrians had gotten a, quote, bad rap, unquote, for terrorism. Shortly thereafter, several more hostages were released. Shortly after that, the CIA was told to stop investigating a Syrian connection to the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, and focus attention on Libya. One of the questions I have, and I don't know if you're in a position to answer this directly, but I've wondered about that report, the Interfor report.
Oh, no, it's a complete bungle. He had snippets, bits and pieces of information, but by and large, just a waste of time.
Okay, so in other words, you agree with the contention that that was a bad report.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I think that the bottom line is that Manzur al-Qasar was playing on both sides of the fence. The Iranians had contracted with Syrian intelligence to carry out a series of attacks. The Iranians gave the money to the Syrians. Manzur's group in Germany, the PFLP-GC, was supposed to carry out the bomb attacks, but they got raided by the West German police, and identical bombs were seized. Manzur then subcontracted the hit on the Lockerbie plane to Libyan intelligence.
So
at the same time, Manzur betrayed the Libyan plans to the British.
Okay.
Okay, that's how we knew to pull our American diplomats off the plane. Okay?
So in other words, you do not agree with the Interfor report, but you do feel that Manzur al-Qasar was centrally involved in the bombing?
Well, in terms of after the original plans went awry in Germany, he just subcontracted the job out.
One of the things I've wondered about, too, is the group of U.S. military intelligence operatives that died on that plane, the McKee team, they're termed. Is there any connection between them and the ISA group that you alluded to earlier?
I'm not at liberty to comment on anybody's membership in a particular agency, but I think that was simply an unfortunate coincidence. I have found no evidence to confirm that that was a direct hit. The information that Manzur passed on to Western intelligence was just that one of the Pan Am planes would be hit, didn't say which one.
Okay, well, again, I didn't want to put you on the spot. I realize the sensitivity of your position. Moving on to another of the intelligence-related scandals that emerged onto the public scene in the late 1980s and 90s, the Iraqgate or BNL scandal. Now, you and your author, co-author mention that too, had its genesis with the private intelligence agency run by oil man George Bush.
Yeah, I think George Bush is a nice guy who does favors for his friends. And unfortunately, his big mistake was trusting people like Casey. Bush, I don't think, is an anti-Semite. I mean, when I went through his private files at the Skull and Bones Club at Yale, I found out, for example, that George Bush voted to admit Jews and blacks to Yale. But the idea of a private spy organization was somehow appealing. And he'd been a former head of the CIA, but didn't really know all that much. And Casey was saying this is a good idea. And the CIA was dragging its feet. They didn't want to get involved in a lot of illegal covert operations, didn't want to arrive the bad old days of Watergate and things like that. And so they went ahead and put the little private spy shop together. The irony is that one of Bush's friends, Tom Clancy, has written a novel about this called Ops Center, in which the hero is Gregory Donnell, who is thinly disguised as Don Gregg. That was Bush's CIA assistant, and later in the White House, Vice President Bush's deputy, who was in charge of this little spy shop.
One of the chapters one of the last chapters deals with some of the machinations that underlay the Persian Gulf War. Specifically on page 488, you write in a chapter called The Victors and the Victims, "The old spies have a very interesting explanation for Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. American oil companies told him it was all right to invade, so he did. The oil companies were the only ones who agreed that Iraq had a legitimate gripe against Kuwait." Then you go on to say, the tip of a banana-shaped oil field in southern Iraq extends 3 miles across the Kuwaiti border. And then you go on to indicate that curious aspect of the oil fields figured into the Persian Gulf War. Could you develop for us?
The Kuwaitis were pumping their tip of the oil field dry and not paying any compensation to the Iraqis, as was supposed to be done under international oil agreements. And Saddam Hussein was furious. Also, at the same time, the Iraqis were billing him $10 billion for the money they'd loaned him during the war with Iran. And the American oil advisors on the scene said, oh, this is terrible what the Kuwaitis are doing. And no one would really mind if he went and took that corner of the oil field. Well, if he gives Saddam 3 miles, he's going to take the whole country. And he went in. He never figured the Americans would object. After all, he was selling the oil to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we started this, the relationship with Iraq, they were selling, like a tiny amount, 50,000 barrels a day. And it later grew to like 1.8 million barrels a day. I mean, we were his best customer. And we had a special spy base in Iraq. We were giving them satellite photography to help with the war in Iran, training their soldiers, directing their military strategy. And, you know, we were the guys that saved Saddam Hussein from defeat in the war with Iran. So we, you know, Saddam Hussein had every reason to believe that what these oil companies were telling him was, in fact, official Washington policy.
So, in other words, he was basically lured in by the petroleum agency, by the petroleum companies.
Yeah. Well, it's a confusion on both sides. But that's what happens when you try and have foreign policy run by a bunch of private companies.
And, of course, ultimately, the United States wound up fighting and, unfortunately, not losing too many men against the armed forces of Saddam Hussein, which were armed to a large extent out of some of these machinations.
Yep.
John, by way of concluding this interview, I would like to perhaps take a look to the future as we speak on June 2nd of 1995. There is a great deal of attention and also angst about the possibility of U.S. ground troops being involved in the Bosnian War, although certainly the excesses of the Serbs in that conflict are not to be overlooked or dismissed in any way or exonerated. In fact, the genesis of this tragic conflict, one which may involve U.S. troops, could even conceivably expand to a larger war, in many ways goes back to some of the elements that we've already spoken about in connection with the fascist freedom fighters and also the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council. The Croatian fascists, the Ustashi, figure prominently in some of the things that you and Mr. Ahrens discuss. And in fact, the genesis of the tragedy now unfolding in the former Yugoslavia came when Germany, which has long been very close to the Ustashi elements, and the United States and the rest of the EC, Germany and the rest of the EC and the United States, recognized the secession of Croatia and, I believe it was Montenegro, from the former Yugoslavian Republic.
Yep. It's the old cycle of our failure to pursue Nuremberg and pursue the Nazi war criminals has, or in the last 50 years, come back to haunt us. The end of World War II, countries like Croatia were snap frozen. They went from fascism to communism. They had no experience in democracy. And now the old fascist symbols and aspirations have just, you know, come back to full life with the full support of Germany and a few other countries, in fact. I think that we've got two choices. We can either do what we did in the Holocaust and pretend that it isn't happening, or we can all go in, as we did in the Middle East, and put the fire out quickly before it spreads. I don't think there's any middle option.
By the way, it was Slovenia. It was not Montenegro, but Slovenia, I think back on it. It's interesting, though, that the match to that particular tinderbox was applied by the secession of Croatia. And to a considerable extent, Franjo Tuđman and the government there has recapitulated some of the more odious aspects of the Ustashi regime.
And it openly adopted some Ustashi symbols and revered some of the Ustashi leaders. It's really sad. It's pathetic.
And in fact, to a certain extent at least, the tragedy in the former Yugoslavia represents a continuation of the bloodletting of World War II. It was sort of held in suspended animation. The Serbs were dealt with very harshly by the Croatians, and now, in a sense, they're effecting their revenge.
I found it interesting that the leaders of the American Jewish community are very, very supportive of the Muslims in Bosnia, because I think they recognize parallels to the Holocaust. During World War II, the American public didn't know then what was going on, but our intelligence community did. I was reading accurate weekly reports of the number of Jews being killed as early as September 1941. We closed our eyes and turned away.
One of the things that's interesting, too, is you discuss some of the reports reaching, among others, former Supreme Court Justice Brandeis. And he said in response to an account of what was going on at Auschwitz, he said, "I know you believe what you're saying, but I cannot accept it as true," or words to that effect.
Yeah. Well, that's because he was speaking to one Jewish survivor. What Justice Frankfurter didn't know was that the British Secret Service, the Polish Underground, the Vatican were all feeding U.S. intelligence with the full breadth and width of the Holocaust. And the British government and the American government were lying to the press about it. We're saying we could not confirm it when we knew it was going on. Last year, the British press reported that they started to declassify some of the German codes that Churchill was reading. The first codes that the Germans broke were for the mobile killing units on the Nazi troops on the Eastern Front.
Mm-hmm.
We knew it all.
And anti-Semitism is something that is by no means, as we've seen, alien to the United States. We're almost out of time, John, but in the wake of Oklahoma City and once again discussion of alleged Jewish conspiracies, the revival of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, how do you feel the lessons of your book relates to what is going on in that regard today?
You know, I'm just an Irish Catholic, but I warned some of the Jewish groups 12 years ago that anti-Semitism is cyclical in America and it's coming back in a big way. People want to look for scapegoats. And the Jews are easy. The tiniest ethnic minority in America, they're easy to push around. There's a long history of doing that.
John, I would like to, in conclusion, extend my thanks to you and Mark Ahrens, and also, and this might seem a little corny or pretentious, I would also like to extend my thanks and also perhaps the thanks of the American people and all of humanity to the old spies. If they never get a direct thank you anyplace else, please extend my thank you, and I suspect on behalf, I'm safe in thanking them on behalf of the American people and the human race.
I think it's very important and very appropriate. These people wanted to let the truth be known before they died. 30, 40 years from now, the rest of the records will be declassified, and my children and grandchildren will know that I had spoke and interviewed the men who wrote those documents. It's an important part of history. It's an ugly part of history, and we should face up to it.
As Adlai Stevenson once said, a lie is an abomination unto the Lord and a present comfort in difficult situations. I think you and your co-author have done much to clear up the lies of history. Once again, we've been visiting with John Loftus along with Mark Ahrens, the author of The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, St. Martin's Press, hardcover, 1994. John Loftus, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you, Dave.